Well, hello everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to another Weber Training teleclass, the very last teleclass of 2009. We're joined today by Dr. Michelle Alpha, who will present environmental cleaning audits. Do they help reduce the spread of C. difficile and AROs in healthcare facilities? The next time you find yourself trolling through the recordings library section on WeberTraining.com, enter Alpha, A-L-F-A, in the search field. You'll find that Dr. Michelle Alpha gave her first teleclass lecture in 2002 and that she has given a presentation every single year since then. Now, that's a distinction unique to her, and I think it stands as a testament to how much I like this wonderful lady and also to how intelligent and eloquent she is. She even gave one of her teleclasses from a hotel in Germany once. Dr. Alpha is the Medical Director of Clinical Microbiology for the Diagnostic Services of Manitoba. She is Principal Investigator in Infectious Diseases for the Canadian Center for Agri-Food Research in Health and Medicine, and one of her primary areas of research is Clostridium difficile-associated diarrhea. She is widely published on that topic, and she is also widely recognized as a global expert on the topic. But before Dr. Alpha begins her presentation, I'd like to acknowledge the sponsor for this teleclass, Virox Technologies. Now, Virox has been and is a very good supporter of teleclass education and of infection control education as a whole. We're very grateful to them for their ongoing support. Thank you, Nicole and the gang at Virox. So now to present the teleclass, Environmental Cleaning Audits, Do They Help Reduce the Spread of Clostridium difficile and Antibiotic-Resistant Organisms in Healthcare Facilities? From beautiful Winnipeg, Manitoba, I give you Dr. Michelle Alpha. Michelle.
Well, thank you, Paul. After that introduction, what can I say? I was glad that you didn't comment my long duration of presenting at Weber teleconferences has to do with my old age. You know, you took a positive spin on it, which is good. The discussion I'm going to have today is on environmental cleaning audits. I think it's a very topical issue, and many of the centers across Canada have actually initiated or have read about some of the auditing methods that are available, and so we thought this would be a very interesting topic to present. If you go to the second slide or second page in your presentation, I did want to acknowledge the research lab staff and the graduate students I have in my lab that I forced to do all these nasty studies, and in particular would like to thank and acknowledge Adriana Trageman. She's a master's student in the research center, and Dr. Manikam and myself co-supervise her, and much of the data I'm going to present toward the end of my talk will be from her master's program. So I would certainly like to acknowledge all her hard work and efforts in this area. And some of the findings have been actually very surprising to all of us. So I think you'll be interested in the results of her research studies. The next slide that I have is really just a disclosure. I like to at least indicate that certainly I've had industry sponsorship for travel costs and honoraria from a wide range of different companies. I do not support or promote any particular industry or company, but did want to at least acknowledge and disclose the fact that often there are sponsorships that I do get. So in today's presentation, if I mention particular companies or products, it's not because I'm trying to endorse them. It's just that it may relate to the particular studies that we're doing. So if you can go to the next slide, which is basically an overview of what I'd like to address in today's webinar, I would like to discuss some issues relating to the role of the environment in transmission of antibiotic-resistant organisms, or AROs, in the healthcare setting. And many of the members of this audience are probably already convinced of this, but I want to at least share the information that's in the published literature regarding the role or the potential role that these organisms play and the role that the environment in particular plays in their transmission. There is no absolutely definitive study that conclusively shows transmission from the environment to the patient, but there are a lot of studies that actually show correlations between them, and we truly believe the environment is the source of many of the nosocomial infections that get transmitted. I would like to touch, and part of our objective today was really to talk about the environmental cleaning audits that are actually available. Most commonly in the past, visible inspection was used, but there's a number of other ones that have been published, and I'll just touch briefly on those so that you're at least aware of the other ones. And then what I would like to do is switch to some of the auditing feedback studies that Adriana's master's program has undertaken and share with you some of the data from that study because it's quite informative. So if we go to the next slide, I really think this slide, these are words to live by. Bartley in 2008 made the statement, a culture report should not dictate the practice of standard precautions. And I really, really believe that. You should treat patients based on their symptomatology and clinical symptoms. And in many ways, we actually respond and do things differently when we get a culture report. And I think that that paradigm is one we need to be aware of. There are some in infectious diseases and infection control that would say any patient with diarrhea, who in particular may be incontinent, you need to be careful of how you handle the environment they're in, because obviously with diarrhea and being incontinent, they're going to shed things into their environment. The antibiotic-resistant organisms that we tend to focus on are VRE, or vancomycin-resistant enterococci, MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, extended-spectrum beta-lactamase-producing organisms, which are referred to as ESBLs, C. difficile, favorite and near and dear to my heart, and Acinetobacter species as well. So we tend to focus on these antibiotic-resistant or problematic organisms in nosocomial transmission, but I think it's important, the last bullet on this slide, really improvements to cleaning in the environment and healthcare will reduce all AROs, not just one subset. We don't need to specifically target MRSA or target C. difficile. Any improvements that you can get in environmental cleaning, the expectation is that they would reduce all of those AROs if they're present in the environment. Now, one of the other things I like to touch on is the concept, the healthcare challenges, and I call it the bum to toilet ratio, which if you're a hospital like the hospital that I'm currently located in, we often have rooms where there's multiple patients in the same room, and frequently the toilet may be shared between two rooms. And it's a challenge that we all face. I know that in some of the provinces, they're starting to implement the concept that really one patient, one room, much like a hotel room, if you will, in terms of the occupancy, is an ideal way to go when it comes to trying to prevent nosocomial spread of microorganisms. But the reality is that many of us function within healthcare that have multiple patients and often shared toilets. And so the inadequate cleaning of one toilet facility may actually affect a large number of patients. So that's the reality of the environment we're working in. And what we want to try to do is come up with ways to improve what's going on and obviously reduce the risk of transmission to patients. So if you go to the next slide, I've got a picture of a nice toilet facility and a healthcare facility and one of those ever notorious bedpan sprayers on the back wall. And in most instances in healthcare, the housekeeping personnel, the audit tool, and they are often used in healthcare, the audit tool is visual assessment. Now, if you just look at the toilet itself, the white structure, it looks pretty clean, doesn't look too bad. If you look and the high mag little insert that I've put there is the end of that bedpan sprayer, and yes, you are correct, those brown things are what you think they are. That is poop on the end of the bedpan sprayer. Now, visual assessment tells you right away that bedpan sprayer end is obviously not adequately cleaned, but it's an extremely crude measure. If we have to see gobs of poop before we recognize that it hasn't been adequately cleaned, it's extremely crude as an audit tool. The other point, which is in the bullet at the bottom of the slide, is even though that toilet may look clean, it may not have been cleaned or disinfected since several days ago, because you cannot see the microbes that may be present, and even though it doesn't visibly look dirty, it might be that it actually has not been physically cleaned in several days, because you can't tell by visual assessment whether or not it has been cleaned. And one of the supporting pieces of information is in the next slide. Microbes survive on surfaces for extremely prolonged periods of time. I've presented some data in this slide that represents some of the studies done by Rose Howey in 2009 that have been published. And looking at MRSA, VRE, you can see that certainly they survive for many days on a surface. But the asterisks above those histograms are meant to indicate that if they're in organic debris, so for instance, body secretions or dust, they can survive anywhere up to 6 months in the environment. ESBLs, which are gram-negatives, and the Acinetobacters, which are gram-negatives, you'll see tend to not survive for as long a period of time as the other gram-positive organisms, but they still can be on the surface for several days anyway. And the ever-notorious foe, C. difficile, in its spore form, can survive for up to years in a dried surface. So there's no doubt that even though the surface may look visually clean of poop or debris or things like that, microorganisms may still be there. And one of the points I like to emphasize to the housekeeping staff is if you are being stressed and pushed because there's so much work to do and you're being pulled to go and reprocess rooms that have had patients discharged because they want to hurry up and admit a new patient, it's important to remember that even if the toilet surface or any surface looks clean, it still needs to get that physical wiping and cleaning every time. Because there is a lot of stress on our housekeeping staff to hurry up and get through a large number of rooms, and one of the shortcuts that might be taken is, oh, well, it all looks pretty clean. I can probably leave it for today and I'll come back and do it tomorrow. But the reality is the microbes don't sleep and they certainly do survive on those surfaces. Now, the other thing that is quite interesting, if you look at some of the published data, there is no doubt that microorganisms carried by these patients do get shed into the environment. So on the next slide, which is environmental detection, this is assessing how widespread does MRSA get in the environment if the patient has diarrhea and actually has MRSA in their stool. And interestingly enough, you can see the bed rails, 100% of patients that had MRSA in their stool and that patient had diarrhea, their bed rails are going to have MRSA on them. The blood pressure cuff, 88% of those had MRSA, and you can see even the bed table, bedside table, has a large percentage, and not surprisingly, the toilet as well. Now, what I'd like to emphasize is the sites that get the highest contamination in the environment are what we would refer to as the high-touch sites. They are ones frequently touched not only by the patient, but also by their visitors, also by some of the staff that might come into the rooms to give them care. And I think it's important to recognize that with this high a level of colonization, the risk is definitely very high that other people touching those surfaces will acquire those organisms. Now, the other interesting piece of information is in the little bulleted box at the bottom of this slide. If the patient is MRSA positive, but it's not in their stool, and of course we all know the most common place of colonization is the nose, so let's say you've got an MRSA positive patient, but it's not in their stool and they don't have diarrhea, you will still find 30% of the environmental surfaces will be contaminated with MRSA. So I'm presenting you a range of carriage anywhere on the body, what percentage of the environment will get contaminated, and if patients have it in their stool and they have diarrhea, you can see that upper bound is at 100%. Now, the other thing that is interesting, and this study, I think, helps destroy a statement that I've often myself heard people say. They'll say, I'm going into the room of a patient with MRSA, they're on isolation precautions, but I don't need to take the or get the adequate personal protective equipment because I'm not going to touch the patient. And I'm sure many of you have also heard that statement. Well, this was a study that was done by Boyce in 2007, and what they found is if they checked and they sent nurses into the rooms of patients that had MRSA, the nurses did not touch the patient, so no patient contact. 42% of those 12 nurses contaminated their gloves with MRSA simply by touching objects in the room with patients who had MRSA either in a wound or in their urine. And I think this is really an important learning point, because often it is cumbersome to put on the appropriate personal protective equipment when you're going into the rooms of patients on isolation. But this type of study demonstrates why everybody should be putting and wearing the PPE that's appropriate, because even if you're not touching the patient, if you touch anything in the room, and you might not be intending to touch anything, but we all know how our hands have a life of their own, and they might end up on a chair or the bed rail or something, you have a definite risk of acquiring it on your hands. And those people who go in not touching the patient often don't think they need to also wash their hands when they leave the room. So I'm hoping that this one slide will be a useful one for everyone to use as, I guess, ammunition in convincing people that when you go into a room of a patient on isolation, you really should be putting on the appropriate PPE. Now, the other data that has been published, this was a study done by Huang et al. In 2006, and they indicated that there was a small but increased risk of MRSA acquisition if a patient was admitted to a room previously occupied by an MRSA patient. So this is not conclusive evidence of the environment causing the or facilitating the transmission, but it is also its correlative evidence that suggests definitely the environment may be playing a role in the acquisition of MRSA, and in particular related to issues around whether the environment might actually be a source. So we all know this. The information I'm sharing with you is maybe some current data, but the reality is, how do we eliminate, and you go to the next slide and talk about how to eliminate the chain of transmission. We know that if we ensure environmental cleaning and disinfection is done properly and hand hygiene is complied with, we should be able to break the chain of transmission. And that sounds easy, but we all know it's not working. And why isn't it working? If you go to the next slide, I've tried to synopsize some of the issues here that I think are the key ones. Compliance with hand hygiene is absolutely critical. There is no doubt that when you get good compliance with hand hygiene, you will impact on transmission within healthcare facilities. The problem is it's really hard to achieve high levels of compliance, and we all spend a huge amount of time trying to improve on the hand hygiene compliance. In terms of the environment, reducing environmental sources of these organisms does reduce healthcare-associated infection. There is evidence to suggest that is the case because it reduces colonization as well. But the question is, how do you tell whether you've gotten good cleaning compliance or not? Because we're saying if you clean your environment, you will reduce the source of these organisms. But how do we ensure that our environment is actually being properly cleaned? And that takes us to the next slide. I want to touch on this aspect as well, because with C. difficile spores, which are extremely difficult to eradicate, we all know, and the PIDAC document recommends it, that if you're having ongoing transmission, you can increase the frequency of the housekeeping being done in the rooms of patients with C. diff disease, and they also suggest that you may want to switch and use bleach at a 1 in 10 dilution or 5,000 parts per million. And the reality is that no matter which agent you use, if the physical cleaning isn't part of it, you are not going to get the benefit of that disinfecting agent. This data is information that we have come up with from studies that we've done. So if you look at the graph on the left-hand side, this is where C. difficile spores were put onto a defined area on a toilet seat. And I will say, it's a study research toilet seat, not one up on the wards. We have a whole range of toilet seats in the research lab, so if you can picture that. The C. difficile spores were put in an organic load, and they were allowed to dry on the surface of the toilet seat. And then the agent, in this case bleach at 5,000 parts per million, was spritzed on the surface and left without any physical wiping. So it was left until the bleach dried, and it took about 3 to 5 minutes for that to happen. But what I'd like you to note is 5,000 parts per million bleach, which is shown on this graph on the left, did not eradicate all those C. difficile spores. And you know why that is, because number one, that's not the recommended concentration of bleach. That's a 1 in 100 dilution. Even the 1,000 parts per million bleach did not kill all the C. difficile spores. And that's because it's a low concentration, lower than what is recommended. But even the 5,000 parts per million bleach, which is the recommended concentration, it dropped the level of spores by about 4 logs, but it didn't completely eradicate them, most likely because the organic material inactivated the bleach and therefore it wasn't able to completely kill all the spore forms present. Now, if you look at the graph that I put on the right side, this is where the same process of inoculation was used, the same C. diff spores. It was spritzed with the bleach and this concentrations I've indicated, but it was then given one physical wipe by an individual with a cloth wetted with the same agent. And you can see immediately, even the 500 part per million and the 1,000 part per million got much more decrease in the spores because they're physically removing it as well as killing it. And the 5,000 parts per million bleach is now completely effective and there were no viable spores left. What this tells you, or the take-home message from this slide, is it's absolutely critical that the physical action be combined. And if you don't get a physical wiping, even with bleach, you are not going to get the killing effect you might think you're going to get when it's in the presence of an organic challenge. So bleach is great. My mother taught me, and I grew up on a farm, and bleach is next to godliness because it kills everything, and even she knew that way back when. And it is an excellent sporicidal agent. The problem is at 5,000 parts per million, the fumes create a very significant workplace safety hazard, and we all know that we would prefer not to use bleach if we didn't have to. So let's switch gears and go to the next slide. What's available out there in terms of assessing whether or not the cleaning was actually done properly by housekeeping? And there are, at least at this point, 4 different approaches that can be taken to audit whether or not there has been cleaning compliance in the healthcare facility. One of them is to use a UV marker, an ultraviolet. It's a lotion that has a compound in it that fluoresces under UV light, and you all know this one. I'm going to touch bases on it, but it's the one marketed to look at hand washing compliance. And if you use this to inoculate a surface and then assess it a day later, and the UV fluorescence is still fine a day later, you can determine whether or not that surface was actually wiped or not. So all that's being assessed with the UV marker is, did the surface get a physical wipe which removed the fluorescent marker? And there's a number of studies that are already out and published. Ourselves and a number of other groups have actually published on this. But what's depressive is when you look at the background level, this would be the level of physical wiping that is experienced in healthcare facilities that don't use the UV marker as their audit tool. They're actually using visible cleanliness as their audit tool. And it was a shock to recognize, but probably not unexpected. It's like hand washing. You expect everybody does it, but when you audit it, you find out that if you've got 50%, you're doing pretty good. Same thing with the UV marker. You know, between 20 to 57% of the surfaces were actually being cleaned, and that means that up to 60% of those surfaces were not actually being physically wiped. So we have a ways to go in terms of making sure we're getting the compliance we think we need to keep these organisms out of the environment. The second audit tool that I've indicated here is ATP. This is a molecule that is a energy storehouse and therefore is found in often organic material like body secretions from humans will have ATP in them. And microbes, because they're living organisms that use ATP as their energy, you can find ATP in microorganisms as well. And what has been published in the literature is that it's a method that can actually be used to assess whether or not the surfaces have had organic and microbial removal on them to a level that would be acceptable. This method is actually very widely used in the pharmaceutical industry in terms of production of pharmaceuticals and in the food and cosmetic industry to assess the cleanliness of the production area. It hasn't been widely applied to the medical field, and I think that is changing because there's more and more reports coming out that it can be used. But you need to remember that if there has been autoclaving or a high-level disinfectant use, that will inactivate the ATP, and therefore they may still be dirty, but the ATP as a measure may not pick up the fact that this surface is maybe not as clean as you want. But it is an excellent measure if you're looking at surfaces in the environment or you're looking at medical devices. For instance, it's been applied to endoscopes after they've been manually cleaned but before they've been disinfected to assess was the cleaning done properly. And I think that it is actually a good methodology, but it requires equipment and test kits, so it's a little more expensive. The viable count method is a traditional one, and it's where you would sample the surface or use a media to assess viable replicating organisms. And there's been suggestions that we should be able to attain less than 5 colony-forming units or CFUs per square centimeter if the cleaning has been done adequately. But again, it takes at least 24 hours because you have to incubate those plates and see whether there's viable organisms there. And at the very bottom, I put visible inspection. Does it look clean to the naked eye? Now, of these 4 methods, for the rest of my talk today, I'm going to focus solely on the UV marker. My reason for doing that is simply because it's probably the cheapest, easiest to implement, and easiest to use audit. But you need to remember, the only thing it's assessing, it doesn't measure organisms being present. It just assesses, was the surface wiped by a physical wipe? But that is probably one of the key things we want to assure when we're auditing housekeeping in healthcare facilities. So if you go to the next slide, just to give you some background, the UV marker as an audit tool, the UV light is shown on the left top side of the picture here. And yes, I've put the website down for the Brevis company. Again, I'm not trying to promote them as a company, but just this is the UV lotion that was used in the studies that we've done for environmental auditing. And you can see those 2 pictures of the research toilet seats. The one that has a 3 beside it means that's a maximum score. That's what it looks like when you apply the UV marker and then shine the UV light to see if it's there. And yes, even if you leave this marker for several days on a toilet seat, it will still show this level of fluorescence. So it's a good marker, which, if the protocol is being followed, it should be removed. This lotion is totally water-soluble. It's innocuous. It has no ill effects on the patients. And we do put the mark on the underside of the toilet lid so that we don't have patients walking around with fluorescing behind because they sat on our UV marker. And the bottom panel that's shown there with a 0 beside it represents what it looks like when that surface is completely wiped. And if I got any one of you in the audience to do 1 wipe with a wet cloth on this surface, you would completely remove that UV marker and the score you would see is a 0. So it's a way to assess, was the surface you put it on actually physically wiped? Now, the graph that I'm showing you on the right was data that has been submitted, and this was from an audit and a study that we did looking at C. difficile on patients on isolation precautions where they were getting twice daily cleaning. And what I would like you to look at is the percent of samples on the left y-axis of the graph shows you what percent of the toilet seats that were assessed showed the UV score that's shown on the x-axis. So a 0 score means total cleaning. A score of 3 means absolutely no cleaning because there was nothing wiped. And a score of 1 or 2 represent that there was some physical action that occurred on that toilet seat. And we've presented the data for patients that were on isolation. They're the blue bars. And compare those, because one of the arms of our study were patients that were not on isolation, and those are the yellow bars. And what you can see is if you look at the percentage that had no cleaning whatsoever, there's really not much difference between patients on isolation precautions and those not on isolation. So our policy that says these rooms of isolation patients with C. diff get twice daily cleaning, we're obviously not getting any bang for our buck because they're not getting more physical wiping being done for the toilet. So this data shows you, and it was one of our initial studies, and we've also published that the UV tool actually works really quite well. And we feel that if you take a score of 0, 1, or 2 and just pool those all together, those represent some cleaning. and a score of 3 represents no cleaning. And so a lot of the data I'm going to present will actually be with that approach. Okay. So enhanced frequency of cleaning of rooms was not being achieved, and I would like to make the statement that is given in the next slide on red. Routine cleaning really needs to be the focus. The risk of highest transmission is actually prior to the diagnosis being made, for instance, with C. difficile. Until you make that diagnosis, the patient may have diarrhea, but you don't actually know whether they've got C. diff or not. So whatever cleaning is the routine is your only hope to make sure the environment has been adequately dealt with. So I would suggest that we need to focus on getting our routine cleaning up to a level that's the best we can achieve. And hopefully one of the ways to do this would be to improve the compliance by giving feedback to the staff. And as I mentioned, we defined cleaned as a score of 0, 1, or 2. In other words, there was some physical wiping that actually occurred on that surface. Now, with the Adriana's master's program, we actually had a psychologist involved on her committee, and one of the things that she suggested is that you want the cleaning staff to embrace this, and this is a tool that shouldn't be viewed as punitive. It should be viewed as something they can use to demonstrate that they really did do a good job. And so as part of the project in the study, we didn't implement that aspect. But when you are looking at implementing this, you want to have your housekeeping staff involved. And in fact, the psychologist suggested maybe the best thing is give the UV marker to the housekeeping staff, and they can check to make sure that they've actually done proper cleaning. Now, the cynics among us would say, oh, they might just look for the spot and just clean the spot, but I don't think so. The idea of empowering and incorporating housekeeping in with the infection control team is a really important aspect. So with this in mind, if we go to the next slide, Adriana was a busy lady over the years that she was in her master's program, and this is an example. On this slide, it was looking at auditing using the UV marker patient bathrooms, and these were patients not on isolation precautions. The blue bar that you see in this graph at time zero, this was the level of cleaning achieved when the visual audit approach was being used and the housekeeping supervisor was actually using the UV marker a little bit just to assess what the baseline level was. And so 50% of the spots were actually being physically wiped and cleaned. Now, in the study that we undertook, the 4 sites assessed were the toilet, the sink in the bathroom, the doorknob, the door in and out of the bathroom, and the soap dispenser in the bathroom. So they're all sites in the patient's toilet. 192 sites were tested per week. So every one of these bars that you're looking at represents a large number of sites. And you can see that even when Adriana started going in every day and applying the marker and then auditing it, and the housekeeping staff saw her around, they knew there was some study that was about to start, but the baseline level was pretty solid, and it ranged from around 46 to about 64%. Where the UV marker had some level of physical removal. Okay, so that's kind of the background level before we started giving any feedback to the housekeeping staff. If you go to the next slide, one of the things the psychologist also suggested we do is discuss with the housekeeping staff what do they think is the percent compliance that they should be able to achieve with their cleaning. And it was really interesting because initially they all said, well, of course it should be 100%. And we finally said, well, don't set the bar too high. You know, try and be realistic. In the end, they settled on 90% compliance. That's what the housekeepers themselves thought they should be able to achieve. And so what happened is, this is the data from Adriana's study, and you can see that week zero is that blue bar showing you about 55% was the baseline. I've not put in those 6 weeks that we did in the intervening just to make sure that baseline was stable, but week one represents when Adriana was going in and putting the UV marker on every one of those spots, and you can see within a few weeks, this arm actually reached the 90% level that is shown by the green line in the graph, and that was their targeted 90% compliance. Now, this arm of the study represented 2 different wards, and there were multiple housekeeping staff. The housekeeping staff in this facility are actually dedicated to the ward, and there are also a lot of casuals or part-times that are employed, and every one of the little asterisks that you see above the bars, represents a week where casuals were employed in this arm of the study. And we're going to reveal some interesting things about that aspect of it as we go on. This arm of the study got feedback for the entire 24 weeks of the evaluation, and you can see they did a darn good job of actually getting pretty close to most of the time having 90% or above compliance, which is excellent. And you can see that unlike the previous slide, and I'm just going to go back to it, and if you can just have a look back, where the two slides previous, where I showed you that the baseline was 55, but when they weren't getting feedback, you can see that for at least 6 weeks, it just hovered around the 60% mark. So without the actual feedback from the supervisor, they weren't improving, or they probably didn't even know they were at 60% because they were getting no feedback. So again, these audit tools are most useful when you give the housekeepers feedback. And the other thing that the psychiatrist suggested, and we did, we wanted to share the value of this, and a poster was made and put on the actual wards that these housekeepers were working on. It could not identify which individual housekeepers were involved for privacy, but the arm and the wards that were involved, this was actually posted so that patients, staff, and housekeeping staff knew how they were doing in terms of their percent compliance. And we think all those factors facilitated getting such good compliance in this arm of the study. Now, if you go to the next slide, we also had two other arms. You can see the top figure represents arm two. And you'll notice on that graph, they got no feedback for the first 12 weeks of the study. And then for the last 12 weeks of the study, they got feedback, the UVM feedback. Now, you notice the interesting thing was, even without feedback, they brought their levels up to what was a much higher level than it had been historically. They weren't getting feedback, but they knew there was a study going on. They probably saw the posters around, and my guess is that had an influence on them, even though they were not getting direct feedback for their ward at that time. And you can see that continued on even into the 12 weeks where they did get feedback. Now, if you look at the data in arm 3, the same thing. In this arm, it's interesting, they really never consistently achieved the 90% target, despite the fact that the housekeeping staff in this arm were all part of the ones that made the decision. And you can see they got feedback right from the beginning for the first 12 weeks, and then we flipped over and gave them no feedback for the last 12. Now, when you look at this data, it's counterintuitive. I would have expected that when they got feedback, they should have brought their level up definitely above the 90%, and that once they did that, they might not lose that cleaning efficiency once we no longer gave them feedback. So in arm 3, I'm not surprised that things didn't change between the first 12 weeks and the last 12 weeks. But what was surprising was in arm 2, they brought up their level, yes, not totally to the 90%, but they did it without getting any feedback initially. And probably it was because they knew there was a study and they probably saw the posters. So in a way, we were giving them subliminal feedback without actually trying. But the other thing I'd really like you to look at is all those little asterisks above all those weeks in arm 2 and arm 3, which represent that there was casual or float staff working in the housekeeping. And what Adriana did, which took a lot of work, was dissect down to understand the individual cleaning behavior. And we, of course, will not share that with you with names, but obviously want to share some of the findings. And this next slide summarizes the impact of casuals on the cleaning compliance. So the percent casuals represents the percent hours or shifts per week that were staffed by casuals. And that seemed to be a reasonable way to look at it. And we've got on the left side of this table, arm 1, 2, and 3 indicated. We've put the two cutoffs. Greater than or equal to 90% compliance was what the staff felt they should achieve. I've also included greater than or equal to 80% compliance because we also feel that was a substantial improvement over what the baseline was at 50 to 60%. Now, if you look at week 1 to 12, Adriana averaged out and the percent casual was 15.3%, and 58% of the time in that first 12 weeks, they achieved 90% compliance. And if we drop the bar down a little bit to 80%, they actually achieve that 83% of the time in those first 12 weeks. So they were doing a pretty good job. And if you look at week 13 to 24, again, they didn't have a huge percentage of casuals, 16.9%. And again, in the last part, they seemed to not achieve 90% compliance as much as they did in the first arm of our first 12 weeks. But you can see at 80%, they were actually pretty good through the entire 24 weeks of the study. But look what happens when your percent casuals increases. And it doesn't take rocket science to see the correlation that as the percentage of casuals goes up, the compliance with that 90% benchmark is really pretty abysmal. And the compliance even with the 80% benchmark is dramatically affected by the percent casuals that are actually there. Now, one of the really interesting things, and I think this was quite fascinating, the other association that Adriana made was that when she looked at this, it wasn't just that they were casuals. It had a lot to do with who did their training. And if there were people that had low percent compliance themselves and they trained the casuals, guess what? The casuals picked up their same traits. And they had very low percent cleaning compliance. If the trainer was one of those staff that was wonderful and was above the 90% and had excellent compliance themselves, how they trained the casuals was reflected in the percent compliance of the casuals. So the take-home message is that as we start throwing casuals and floats into the mix, the ability or the impact that their training has is very significant on the compliance we're getting with environmental cleaning being done. So if there's one thing you want to do, or I would suggest, and I'm sure Adriana and Kanchana would agree with me, is that make sure whoever's training your casuals is somebody who themselves have documented good cleaning compliance, because it will make a big difference in the efficiency of those casuals when they then start being the ones cleaning on the ward. So if we go to the next slide, the other thing I wanted to share with you was breaking down the data by the location in which the UV marker was placed. And the first bar, which is the blue bar, represents the toilet seats. And if we just take the overall of all the data that Adriana has, you can see that toilet seats and the sink, which are the two bars on the left side of the graph, were actually most of the time cleaned quite well. Where people, if they were going to fail in wiping surfaces, it was the soap dispenser and the doorknob that suffered the most in terms of poor physical action of cleaning. And it's kind of worrisome that the soap dispenser would be one of those sites, because we're trying to encourage people to touch the soap dispenser and use it. And if it itself is not being adequately cleaned on the outside, you know, that's not a good thing either. So again, remember, the housekeeping staff themselves probably feel intuitively they're working hard, and they are, but they don't have good audit tools to give them feedback as to where it is that they may not be doing or that they may have room for improvement. So this type of audit where you put the marker on different sites helps you give constructive feedback to the staff so that they know, okay, it's not just the toilets and sinks we need to worry about. That doorknob is important and the soap dispenser is as well. And so you want to make sure they're aware of where there is room for improvement in terms of the cleaning. Now, if we go to the next slide, if I would were to summarize some of these findings, and this is not all of the information in Adriana's master's thesis, I just tried to pick out what I thought were some key take-home messages for this audience, but some of the issues that came out were dedicated ward staff. There's no problem with that. In fact, that's great because they develop a relationship with the nursing staff and everybody else on the ward, but they're often pulled for discharge cleaning. And therein lies a major problem. When we talked with the housekeeping supervisor and even with some of the staff, one of the biggest problems they encountered was that they're in the middle of doing something and they get pulled because a patient's been discharged and they have to immediately drop what they're doing and go and do that discharge cleaning. So the issue is, should there be either staff dedicated solely to discard charge cleaning? Should there be more staff hired overall to accommodate this? Like, we don't have solutions for this yet, but it's been identified as one of their biggest challenges to get their average routine cleaning done is the fact that they're being pulled all the time for discharge cleaning. So it's something to look at in your facility to see whether there's improvement that can be done. Visibly clean may be thought, if the housekeeping staff see that it's visibly clean and they're being stressed and they have to run to another room, they may think it's okay to leave it. So it's important to make sure that housekeeping staff are made aware, just because it looks visibly clean, you still need to clean it every day. That's what's in the policy or the protocol within the healthcare facility. The other point that they made was that when there's a lot of visitors in the room, it definitely disrupts their ability to clean that room. And therefore, it might be that on their shift, they didn't get around to doing it because there was always people in that room and they never got back to it before their shift was over, and that was it. And that might be one of the reasons we don't get the complete compliance we're looking for. And then I've already alluded and discussed with you the issue around casual staff and the adequacy of their training. The findings from Adriana's study were that feedback definitely did improve cleaning compliance. On all three arms, it didn't really matter. Every one of them had definite improvement and sustained improvement beyond what they had before we started using the UV audit and giving them feedback. Cleaning compliance, I didn't show you the data, but it's definitely person-specific. There are some people out there who feel they are doing a good job and they don't care about the feedback, they're stubborn, and they're just going to do things their way no matter what. And I think it's important to recognize that the people you have doing the training of casuals or new staff, you want them to be somebody who has themselves a very good cleaning compliance characteristic. And that, of course, cleaning compliance was affected by the percent casual staffing, but it's not the casual in and of itself. It was the training they received. So it's important to recognize that just the presence of casuals doesn't create a problem. It just depends how well their training is. So if we go to the next slide, I'm going to take just a few minutes to go over the concept, because many people have asked about this. Room fogging with vaporized hydrogen peroxide, or VHP, is something that has been published in the literature, and the reference is actually given for it here. The idea being that you would have no patients in the room, you would put this unit in the room, seal all the doors and close it, and it creates a vaporized hydrogen peroxide vapor that penetrates everything, gets in the nooks and crannies, everywhere. And yes, indeed, it actually is very effective. Now, this graph was taken from Hardy's publication, and really, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but what I'd like you to focus in on is where the terminal cleaning was done and the vaporized hydrogen peroxide was used. Yes, they dropped the levels in the environment down to basically undetectable, but look how quickly that room became recolonized with organisms. And in this case, they were basically looking at MRSA and other microorganisms. So the take-home message here is these vapors like this work well, but you still need to have a process that's going to work on a daily basis, because you can't always have a room with no patients in it, and you can't do this VHP room fogging unless the room is clear of patients. And even if you do it today and you get a patient in there, you still need to do the cleaning on that patient's room on an ongoing basis. So it's not that they don't work. In fact, the VHP works extremely well. And unfortunately, right now, there's no way to apply that on a daily basis because patients occupy the room. But it might be something to consider for terminal cleaning or a periodic kind of bringing you back to baseline in certain places. So if you go to the next slide, if we look at environmental cleaning, I think if you need to recognize that recontamination from the patient, et cetera, occurs rapidly, so we truly do need to have ongoing and effective environmental cleaning process. And the recommendation I would give is that whatever product you're using for cleaning and or disinfecting, you really should have a good audit tool to ensure the cleaning is being done properly. And it should be fed back to the housekeeping staff on posting on the ward, or even just the housekeeping supervisor giving them their feedback, because if it's not fed back to them, they don't know where they need to improve. And the focus, if you're going to focus on areas, really the high touch areas are the ones to focus on, because those are going to give you the greatest impact in reducing the spread of AROs. So if you're going to get your housekeeping to use a UV marker, the sites that they mark should be the high touch areas, because those are going to be the most valuable in improving housekeeping cleaning. Now, you'll notice the studies that I've shared with you are all to do with the toilet facilities, but there's no reason why this marker could not be used in the patient's room itself. So the high-touch areas in the patient's room could also be looked at, but you have to select a location where the patient themselves are not likely going to rub it off by handling that surface. So, for instance, on the doorknob, when Adriana put her UV marker, she didn't put it on the outside of the actual knob structure. She put it on kind of the shaft very close to where the knob was. And that area should be cleaned as part of their routine cleaning. So it has to be an area that would be expected to be cleaned, but not one that would be just rubbed off because a patient was touching it. Now, if we go to the next slide, I'll try to summarize the findings from this presentation, and hopefully I've left a little bit of time so that we can talk about or have questions. So in summary, if there's one thing I would like to promote, it's that Visibly Clean as an audit tool is really just inadequate, and there are simple enough alternatives that we can use that will give much more valuable information to our housekeeping staff. I think the next bullet, which is that the UVM audit tool, you need to recognize its limitations. It's just ensuring that there was a physical wipe. It doesn't tell you that there's no C. diff on that surface. It doesn't tell you there's no MRSA, but it does tell you that your housekeeping staff did wipe that surface. And whether the audit is done by the housekeeping supervisor or whether it's done by the staff themselves, really I think the idea is that they need some feedback. The other thing that I think is really important, we all know that when we have outbreaks, we have our infection control meetings and we have our risk managers there, and that's when we whip out and ask the environmental services team to join us because we all want to work together, but we need them to be part of the infection control team on a regular basis, not just when we have outbreaks. And I think if you can get your auditing and your cleaning compliance up, it might have enough of an impact that it would reduce the outbreaks that you actually do have. Now, the data I've shared with you today has not demonstrated that by getting compliance with cleaning that we've reduced our rates of MRSA or our rates of C. diff. That wasn't the intent of the study. I think we achieved the goal of determining what audit would help us get good compliance with physical wiping, and the additional studies that need to be done are to show that if you get good compliance on a regular basis, does it actually drop your rates of these nosocomial infections? And then the last comment, we all know this one, but it really is true. An ounce of prevention is definitely worth a pound of cure, especially in the battle of the bugs. And my very last slide, how can I leave you before Christmas and holidays and without some very positive thought? And so on the last slide that's here, in my browsing to look at cleaning things, I came across on the website, and these really are commercially available. These slippers are microfiber slippers. So who knows, maybe this will be the latest aid in healthcare. We'll put microfiber slippers on all the patients and our floors will be absolutely spotless. And on that note, I will stop and turn it over to Paul again.
Michelle, thank you very much. As always, a very inspiring teleclass lecture. And also, Adriana, thank you very much. Obviously, you did an awful lot of work for that. I have a question. You mentioned that you posted the results of the cleaning efficiency on the walls. That's a pretty gutsy thing to do, recognizing that your patients are probably expecting 100% compliance, 100% cleaning all the time. Did you get any pushback on that?
It was interesting. We worried about that a lot, and obviously we had to get approval from administration in the healthcare facility because we wanted them, number one, this whole study went through research and ethics approval, and even though we weren't testing on patients, we wanted to make sure that the Research and Ethics Committee were okay with it. And beyond that, we also talked with administration in the facility that we did this study in, and they felt that in actuality that there should be, the expectation from the patients is that they should be getting like 100% cleaning. And you could see that very, very rapidly the percent compliance actually did jump up quite quickly. And actually, we did not get a lot of pushback. I think some of the staff, Adriana used to be hounded by the staff, especially those conscientious ones. They'd be saying, okay, what was my score for today? And she had to tell them, I can't tell you individual scores. But no, it was actually a very positive thing.
You're almost training your patients to expect a little bit less than 100%.
I guess in some respects, yes, but most people, if they're realistic, if we even think of our own cleaning ability, we realize to expect 100% might be unrealistic, and that personally, I mean myself, I would be happy if the cleaning percent compliance was between 80 and 90%. I actually could live with that quite comfortably.
Thank you, Dr. Alpha. It was a wonderful practical lecture. One thing I was a little bit surprised when I saw in the beginning of your picture, the cleaner about the bed for the bedpan, a sprayer, and I am a little bit concerned about that as a control nurse. If you use this, then you will have a lot of problems by spraying all the microorganisms in your mouth and on hands. What can you add to this?
You are absolutely correct, and in fact, this was a picture that was showing kind of the situation that existed, and one of the big pushes from infection control in this city and certainly in the areas across Canada are to get away from the bedpan sprayers for exactly the reason that you alluded to. We all agree they are the worst aerosolizer of spores and microorganisms known to mankind, and one of the pushes is to try to make sure that these are not used and that alternatives are used for things like bedpans. My picture was an old picture, and it's meant to emphasize why they are so bad.
Your slide when you're talking about the MRSA contamination in the environment, it kind of made me question then with respect to housekeeping staff, is there a concern or should we have a concern with housekeeping staff using rubber gloves where they'd use those between room to room as opposed to an exam glove that would be disposed after the room with respect to transmission?
That's a good question, Nicole. And of course, in patients where you have them on isolation precautions, the housekeeping staff do actually don and doff the PPE as per the protocol that would be required of anybody going into the room. So if the patient's on isolation precautions, housekeeping staff will actually be using the appropriate PPE. The problem would be prior to the diagnosis. And yes, they would be using rubber gloves. And again, are those rubber gloves a source of, transmission from room to room? You know, we always worry about the mops and the cleaning cloths, and most of us now are using a cloth for cleaning that, you wipe one surface, you fold it, you then use that clean surface to do the rest, and that you would never take a cleaning cloth from one patient room to the next. With respect to the rubber gloves, we ourselves have not looked at that. I think, obviously that is a potential problem, but, whether or not that would contribute to transfer of organisms to another surface, certainly the potential is there. Is it a big enough risk to warrant recommending disposable gloves for all routine housekeeping in addition to when they're on isolation precautions? Again, I don't have a good answer to that. But I would say it certainly is a concern because it's no different than the mops, which we've changed. It's no different than the surface wipes, that the cloths that we've changed and say you can't take one cloth from one patient's room to the next. But good point. Maybe we'll have to look into that.
I just want to make a comment that we seem to put a lot of emphasis on bathrooms, but a lot of patients that are having diarrhea, for example, they get put into the tents, the diapers, very quickly. And staff would be changing those, use the same gloves to pick up the rails because we're so safety-minded, and then just lace that rail with all the organisms that's in the stool. And yet, the focus seems to be a lot on bathrooms and not on the rails. And I noticed that they're just blind with the MRSA and the stool and diarrhea talk about the rails. But I think sometimes we have to remember, like, those rails are just loaded. And it's not always a bathroom because the patients aren't going there.
Oh, yeah, I think you're spot on. And obviously, we focused on the toilet because our projects, a lot of them are aimed at C. difficile, but even C. diff patients, if they are diapered and they're incontinent, you're absolutely correct. The handling of those diapers, and you didn't go on to talk about where the diapers are disposed of either, because I think that's another kind of travesty, because a lot of times they're just thrown into the toilet or the regular garbage in the patient rooms, which I worry about too. Yes, I think that we need to ensure that staff who are caring for patients are adequately trained on the risk of contaminating the environment and the technique they use to remove diapers and then subsequently touch any surface is a very important part of the training, which I think we are not emphasizing as much as what we need to. And you're absolutely correct. The scenario where the patients are diapered, their environment, their high-touch areas are going to be full of all kinds of fecal microorganisms, and we should be a lot more cognizant of that.
Thank you very much to Virox Technologies for their sponsorship of this teleclass and of teleclass education in general. And Dr. Alpha, thank you again for a tremendous presentation. I always enjoy your energy and your information. You are one of my favorites, that's for sure. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. And I'm glad that you haven't gotten sick of me yet. I said after a few years, I think we'll have to call an end.
I can't imagine that ever happening. To you all, thank you very much, and we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.